All right, welcome everybody. Thank you for joining us in this session titled Why Noah Has Content Protection. I'm really going to introduce Alex Nada. Alex is our lead of security at Media Silo. He's the guy who gets to fill out the security questionnaires and also implement the guidelines.
My condolences.
But it also makes him a security expert. He, along with another colleague of ours, single-handedly wrote and implemented the SafeStream system over the course of a couple of years. So he really is a person of great experience when it comes to content protection security matters. So without further ado, Alex, get started.
Yeah, thank you. I was joking earlier that this is me eating a secure cookie for lunch. When there's not excellent tacos, that's my typical lunch is secure cookies. It's been a long day, and I just want to lighten it up a bit and revisit some of the same themes, but put our own little twist on it. And I'm a fan of memes, so let's joke around about this a little bit. This guy usually is asking for your cheeseburger, but today he's going to ask for easy tools and at the same time security. Basically, the situation we're in is piracy and content leaks are a huge problem. They're not getting any better. What we've seen is that there's this very real tension between usability and security. I think we heard this a couple times today. If you make something too secure so that it's an impediment, users will work around it. And if we don't find a way to make really good systems, easy tools that are secure by default, the problem's just going to get worse because we won't be able to control that entire ecosystem. Let's talk about leaks. The metric that I had, I know you guys heard a lot of statistics today, but the statistic that I heard on piracy is that it reduces revenue by 19%. That is really big. So I said, challenge accepted. I will try to fix a piece of the 19% of lost revenue. What we know about pre-release content is that the piracy value increases as it approaches release. So let's say you have a press screener. It's immediately pre-release. That's extremely high-value content. That's finished content. It's as good as watching the show, as good as going to the movie. Immediately before that, we have late post-production, and I'll be talking about that as well. We do a lot of post-production use cases, review and approval, but other stuff as well, and that's another hotbed of piracy. I don't know if you know this, but memes actually have names, and this guy is named Scumbag Steve by the meme community. This is our prototypical picture. I don't know how accurate this is, but it's our prototypical picture of someone who's leaking pre-release content, in this case, reportedly from a press screener. Another weird statistic, surprising statistic to me, 92% of award screeners leak. That is a couple years old. It may have gotten worse. It's hard to tell. Yeah.
Because you fire them all.
The DVDs and online?
Both, yeah. Screeners, yeah. I think it's probably everything. And there's definitely there's media issues there, depending on whether it's physical media or screener, e-screener media. In the cases we've seen with our customers, screener audiences are in the thousands. So that's a press screener. When you give a preview to two people at the LA Times and two people at the New York Times, that's four out of potentially multiple thousands of people who are going to see that content have access to the real finished content in at least SD, if not much better, before it goes live. And post-production. Here's the impression that I get of post-production, okay? You have a team that's under a deadline. And here we are in content security saying, why are you doing this? One of our customers recently said on a panel, post is the weakest link in our security chain. And I think he probably wasn't thinking screeners at the time. But post is the next place where the content is very valuable. We've seen leaks from everything. Everything from like scripts and storyboards and conceptual art. And we've seen it in on-set leaks. But late post is definitely a hotbed part of the problem. So let's be honest about this. In my opinion and experience with this, security is getting in the way. It's there to restrict access, and it does a good job at restricting access, which means users see it mainly as inconvenient. They know that it's there. They know that it should be there. I saw a really good presentation at the Content Protection Summit in Mesa, Europe, by the BBC. And they talked about the culture change after the big Doctor Who leak. That is one way to address this, and I think that's really working for them. But there's other problems there, which is, how is it that people had access to that and were able to leak it in such a damaging way? So the philosophy that we've come up with and that I'm evangelizing in this way is, why can't things be secure by default? And we came up with these three rules for developing secure by default systems. First, select effective but unobtrusive controls, which means we have to select controls that will work. Sometimes it's a set of direct controls and maybe some compensating controls. We have to be willing to relax that to the point where it's unobtrusive to the user. But in order to know that that's good enough, number two, we need to measure the effectiveness of that. This can be difficult. We need to know, did it leak? But also, is it in fact unobtrusive? And then we need to repeat that. So if we find that it's too obtrusive and nothing leaked, maybe we can relax it. If we find that it's not effective and we did have a leak in that workflow, we need to really closely examine the workflow and the controls and lock it down further. So let's try to apply these rules. And first, let's talk about passwords. Here's your prototypical problem. Everyone has too many passwords. Sophisticated users can use a vault, which is great, but you're not going to get everybody using the same vault, especially when you're sharing across organizations. I think our enterprise content security's answer to this has been single sign-on and password policies. So even within an organization, what we expected to get out of that is better strength, some rotation on some kind of a schedule, and we trust that that will help the users make more original passwords. How do you guys feel when it makes you change your password? And do you take the time to really make a good password? I generate extremely long passwords with all of the characters. I could never even type them, which sometimes is a problem. But I don't expect that most of our user community is doing that. And even then, that causes usability problems for a lot of users. Even worse, that doesn't actually work. We have research that supports this now, and what we find is what they're actually doing, this is Arthur the Aardvark, by the way, just clenching his fist at any struggle of the day. What they end up doing is they just change their tactics. They're using pattern reuse. Let me just talk for a moment about pattern reuse. So are you guys aware of the LinkedIn breach? LinkedIn had a fairly significant breach in 2012. And at first, what hit the sort of the dump forums and whatnot was some 6 million or so passwords. Or maybe they were SHA-1 hashes of passwords, but SHA-1. You might as well have that password. Unsalted SHA-1.
Unsalted. Yes. No.
And at first, for a few years, we thought that's what it was. We thought it was 6 or 7 million passwords. It turns out we learned earlier this year that it was much larger than that. It was, I've heard two statistics, 117 million passwords or 160 million passwords. Basically, it's everybody's password. Your password, my password, everybody's password. And they were all unsalted SHA-1 hashes that were available for, I think, around $1,000. You could buy them on the black market. 99 plus percent of those passwords have now been cracked. And sophisticated attackers are also studying how we modify passwords, how it is that we take an old password and modify it enough to fit the password policy of reuse and they understand how we use maybe the L and the I, maybe the linked or the in, to make a new password, and then they're going to apply that to other systems. So that's not working for us. Another thing we need to do if we're going to have strong passwords in the password policy is users are going to forget their passwords, and they're going to need more frequent resets, which means we basically either push the problem into email, which, well, sure, that's really secure, right? Maybe, if you have a very controlled environment in email, or you've pushed it into a phone call. And in that case, what you have is an opportunity for social engineering that you didn't have before when it was just a password. Researchers have noticed that users are using what they call less secure memory aids. They're writing down the password on the sticky note. It's just like the worst hacker movie scenario. And security team's response to that is, let's just push multi-factor authentication anywhere, which again might work for internal users, but that's not a usability enhancement. And sometimes, if it asks me for multi-factor, I just abandon it. Just forget it. I don't need to look at that right now. I can't even take the phone out of my pocket and look up a 6-digit thing, right? Assuming you're using an electronic multi-factor. So let me boil that down to post-production, because that's where I think this is a big problem for internal teams. Do you guys know this guy? This is a New Yorker. He is usually complaining about the rent being too high, not the password too long. He ran for mayor in New York a couple times. But his rant applies absolutely to passwords. What we see in post-production is that having to know the password, having to share the password with the recipient, especially if it's an external recipient or an internal customer who doesn't want to be inconvenienced when you have to go bother them to do a review, they're going to resort to things like passwordless sharing. Sometimes with a compensating control, maybe they're going to watch in our activity panel to see that you expired the link. So let me just back up a minute on that. One of our key use cases that we handle in the MediaSala platform is a secure sharing. It's called a quick link. And it's a very adjustable workflow. I think we're going to show you an example of that later on, and you'll get an idea for how it works. Privileged users can lower the security to the point where it's passwordless. And that's one of the things that we see them doing. So it's got great monitoring tools, and if they're using a compensating control where they maybe see that the user has watched the video and then expire the link, that's certainly better than if they just send it out and it's a publicly accessible link that could potentially be tweeted or shared in some other way. The next thing we see is that we're pushing them onto less secure tools. They'll go rogue. They'll use, now it's not called rogue anymore, it's called shadow IT, right? They'll use a shadow IT system or just some cloud system. They'll send a Dropbox link, they'll upload it to Vimeo, they'll use some other mechanism that works around all of our security review. And what we see in post-production is they're under time pressure, expediency wins this argument. They're not going to secure it if it slows down their workflow. What does work? What we're seeing work is now a new combination, and maybe this as well will turn into a problem later, but right now it's working really well, which is device registration and strong endpoint controls. So an example of this is, and again, we'll show you a glimpse of this later, we have iOS apps for reviewers. It's optional, they can still use a web viewer, but if they download the iOS viewer, we'll do a device registration that's similar to a password reset. So we know it's the right person, and then we'll register that device with a long-term auth token. It's persistently logged in. And then we'll rely on strong endpoint controls, which is touch ID and or a long passcode, remote wipeability, so that a lost device, you know, that controls the risk of a really long passwordless auth token in the case of a lost device or a stolen device. That's working pretty well. So now I have a new control. And let's apply the three rules to that. So first of all, I picked controls that are effective. It's got strong endpoint controls. I have Touch ID, pretty much everyone. I could even mandate, or I could buy them devices, right? I can mandate that they're using strong endpoint controls and strongly recommend that. That's effective. Device registration is certainly unobtrusive because I open it up and it's immediately always logged in, and I can see all of my shared links right in there. I need a way to measure that. There's two ways I can measure that. As a software vendor, I'm going to manage whether the device registration is unobtrusive enough by looking at my support tickets. If I'm getting a lot of tickets from users that say they can't use it, it's causing a problem for them, then I know that it's too obtrusive. It's getting in the way. My main metric for are the controls strong enough is those security questionnaires that you guys send me and the follow-up reviews we do. Because if you're telling me that the controls aren't strong enough when we do the review, if we had a leak, that would tell me that they weren't strong enough. But in lieu of having enough, you know, critical mass of incidents to go by, I have to go by the reviews I'm getting from customers saying, this doesn't meet our standards for whatever reason, often accompanied by specific examples. Enough about passwords. Let's talk about another control that we successfully use that seems to be really effective and is often mandated by studios, and that's DRM. So, we all know Willy Wonka here being, not sincere in his enamorment with your topic. What we see in DRM is, first of all, it's hard to manage. You can only support certain platforms because it's a proprietary player on the platform. So maybe you can do iOS, Android, Windows, Mac. Maybe you have to go beyond that, but that's going to be another DRM. You know, you want Apple TV, that's the Apple's DRM. That becomes a support problem and a cost problem. Second, users seem to hate this stuff. I hate it when I get something as DRM because the player is sometimes restrictive. And then beyond that, it can't secure all the workflows. What if they actually have to download it and modify the content? You're dealing with the downloaded file that's outside the system. There are other tools you can use there, but it's not the same control. And content can still be pirated. We can, at the very least, we can screen record it. If not HDMI out, screen capture of some kind, some of the content can still leak. It doesn't entirely prevent it. So we see an increasing trend in the industry. We're, at this point, joined up with it, and part of that increasing trend in the industry, and that is, what if we just watermark everything? This is going to solve all of our problems. Exactly.
You know, the industry is not saying that. Sorry, well, I don't know which industry you are speaking of. We say, yes, you do watermark, but watermark alone? No.
But watermark gives us
a bit too much. You know?
by looking at watermarking, so I'm going to talk about
my part of the industry. You know, my little company. No, not watermark alone. No.
So let's talk about watermarking. Some of this I learned from reading your book about watermarking. So bear with me here. First, let's talk about forensic watermarking. Forensic watermarking, as we've witnessed it in use in post-production sharing and in screeners, is a tracking tool. And it allows us to determine which workflow leaked and find the people that were involved in that accident, sometimes fiasco, sometimes accident. And then we can analyze and improve the workflow. And one thing that we like to point out, partly because we launched visual watermarking before we added forensic watermarking onto it, is that forensic watermarking, because it's invisible, it's not a leak deterrent, unless they know it's there. A lot of stuff that leaks, we think, when it is forensically watermarked, we think that the leakers probably did not realize it was there. I like to talk to Uber drivers about forensic watermarking, because none of them know that such a thing is possible. Just as a metric. So the other side of watermarking, visual watermarking, that is a permanent burned-in mark inside the baseband of a video, not an overlay. We actually modify the video data. What does that give us? Doge tells us much surveillance. This is really interesting as a deterrent. We know it's not really robust against a sophisticated attacker. We've heard stories. No one's ever done this to me yet. I'm looking forward to it. But we've heard that if you send a sophisticated security team visually watermarked video, they might send it back to you with the watermark removed. What's that?
Or modified.
Modified. Blurred. Maybe they're colluding. Maybe they're... Yeah. Combined. They could potentially defeat this. But we know that it's working. So here's a public tweet by a reviewer at Slate who pointed out that Black Mirror was the appropriate show for burning somebody's email into the... It's a dystopian surveillance-related show. And he was pointing out that that's perfect for my email being burned into the video. That means it's working. That is, in fact, a leak deterrent. If we combine the two at the same time, we potentially have a decent solution in concert with authorization, in concert with DRM, in concert with any of the other controls and tools we could put in place. This could potentially help. But we hear this from customers. It's almost a direct quote. It's slow. So if I'm not under a deadline, I might watermark it. I'm supposed to watermark it, they say. Second, it's interruptive to the teams. I need a free edit bay. I need to dedicate some time, even if I have a farm that sits there and watermarks, dedicated hardware. I need to still put it through that process before I send it out. If I'm doing multiple revisions back and forth with the same individuals, and I have to do probably 7 revisions tonight before it goes out, that's not happening. And that's with traditional watermarking. And then finally, because traditional watermarking is really just giving you another asset, I have the original asset, I have the clean asset, I have the watermarked asset. If I choose to create it, I choose which one to send. It's hard to enforce because it's up to each and every individual to decide whether to actually watermark it. But the cost is coming down. So this is Morpheus when he tells Neo, you won't have to dodge bullets. What if I told you you don't have to watermark? Here are some recent advances we've seen. One is two-step processing, where we can front-load the analysis and profiling piece into an ingest step that usually can, in most workflows, in many workflows, can give us a longer period of time to do that. Parallel processing to speed up both the profiling analyzing piece and the embedding piece. Live streaming support, if you can watermark it live, you can probably watermark it not live just as fast. And this allows us to do on-demand watermarking, which you guys have heard us talking about, I think, for a couple of times now. And we'd like to show you an example in one of our own products of what that looks like inside MediaSilo Go, which is that mobile review and approval use case. You want to talk us through this?
Yeah, so I'll just talk you through it. I'm aware that many of you have probably never seen MediaSilo, and I think to illustrate the story, it may be good to just put it into context here. But what's happening here is this is what either a content creator or somebody who's sort of facilitating exchange of content would see. They would log in and they would start, interacting with their footage. In this case, we're selecting these 4 clips and then we're sending them out. What this person isn't aware of is the fact that this whole project that the media is in was marked for default security on. So everything in this project is by default, has a watermark attached to it, and we'll see what this looks like. So in this case, we're just sending this to post at MediaSilo. We've got all of our sort of preferences, security preferences, and our expiration date set on this, and now the data gets sent off. This is fairly typical. This happens hundreds of thousands of times on a daily basis. What is different here, though, is that the people on the receiving end, now get a quick link on their phone. You get a push notification here, and then when you're actually reviewing the content, you'll notice that with about a second delay, the clip that I've just sent plays back. And even though this is a mobile device, but we have some controls over it, you'll notice that there's actually a watermark burned into this, right? So this is a perfect example of security by default and seamless security. And I think this is a really interesting trend in the industry in general. We've not made the person who's sending the content consciously watermarked before, but somebody set a template, somebody knew what type of content this was, so that it wasn't covering lower thirds or, you know, whatever the type of media was, and chose the right template for it. But it was the perfect example of, you know, trust but verify, delegation of responsibility, so that the person who had to get their job done at the end of the day didn't have to think about any of this stuff. And this is just sort of an illustration of this. The second example of this, I think that are we doing the CineSync example?
Yeah, here it is.
The second example of this, this is not something that we've built, but that a partner of ours has built. And CineSync is an Australian company that provides real-time security. Oh, it's not playing back. Real-time collaboration. All right, we'll come back to that with the video maybe playing from your hard drive. In any event, what they've done is... Oh, there we go. Now it's playing. So what they've done is they've actually... So CineSync does synchronous review of content, and it's used primarily in visual effects and animation, where you need frame-accurate drawing on the screen. What they've done is they've taken our public API and said, cool, we're going to make this part of it. Previously, CineSync didn't really provide any orchestration of media. You're responsible for getting your own media downloaded. But what they're showing here is that they've built the SafeStream API into their product, where they, you know, allow them the administrator to just select from a preset template, and now the files, you know, that have been picked locally can be uploaded, and they're orchestrated and distributed across to everyone. And anyone who participates in this synchronous session, you know, 2 people or 5 people or 10 people, receive the media, and as you'll see, it's watermarked to each recipient. Right? Again, if the administrator or the organizer of this meeting would have to watermark content individually for every participant, this would never happen, because you have to front load, you know, an hour and a half of like watermarking in order to even do this. So anyway, this kind of plays out. It took us by surprise how well they've implemented this, but it also goes to show that there's a real need to implement technology with this mindset of security by default. And I think this is a really nice execution of this. So you can see the email address from the session. There's actually a session ID, and the date and the time of this is all implemented in this. And so I think it's a good example that further illustrates this.
These examples you're seeing, I just have to assure you that they do include forensic watermarking, because you can't see it, because it's imperceptible. But for SafeStream, we worked with Content Armor. Their technology was a really good fit for ours and for the speed that we require. And that's really working out for us in SafeStream. One last point about the API. I have just one more case study. That's not a video or a demo, but I just like to speak to it. We had a problem of, post-production especially is extremely diverse, and pre-release sharing is extremely diverse. It's a lot of different workflows. That requires integration. And as Kai mentioned, we offer SafeStream as an API, as we do all of our core products. We're using the same API for our products as for... is available publicly. So the case study we have is a broadcast and production company. This is actually ITV. They had an existing content portal that had their entire library of content in it, but it's all post-release, and there's no watermarking on that. They really wanted to add watermarking for their originals, and they, like everybody else, they're doing more original TV now than they were. So to satisfy first world problem lady here, they really wanted to do an integration where they could put SafeStream into their existing content portal. And we worked closely with the team that built that portal for them, and they added SafeStream. The original content that's not watermarked, the post-release content from their library, plays out from Brightcove, which is what backs their playback for that system. If they check the box that set, you know, the setting on the episode or show that says enable forensic, or enable SafeStream watermarking, that triggers in the back end the ingest to SafeStream, much like the CineSync demo did, but it's invisible to even an administrative user, and then that playback happens from SafeStream. It's just when a potential customer accesses that show, they'll see the watermarked version.
So Alex, I think we're
Yeah, and we're out of time. But thank you. I just wanted to say, no matter what you do, if you have security by default, there's no worries when you hit send too soon. Thanks, and stay safe out there.